Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, David Dayen will join us to discuss how the pandemic is making monopolies worse, the dangers of big tech when it comes to innovation, and a successful congressional hearing on the matter. And Ankush Kadori will be here to talk about his recent piece in the New Republic, "There's Never Been a Better Time to Be a White-Collar Criminal." If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor and support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Heather Digby Parton has the week off, so let's get right into this. Last week, tech giants Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google appeared in front of Congress to detail how large tech platforms abuse their position to invade user privacy, buy up competitors, and gouge suppliers and partners, causing behavior that ultimately damages innovation and exacerbates inequality. Here to discuss, David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect. So, David, you had a piece this week in which you made the proclamation that Congress has triumphantly returned. And I have to say, in this era, when we have seen the House perform what I would call incredibly anemic oversight of the Trump administration, the idea that there may have been something that the House was able to do in a successful way is intriguing and just the kind of good news we need right now. So please do tell us. It was an antitrust hearing.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's almost frustrating because it shows that, you know, what we hear is that there are these unhurdleable barriers to Congress performing its duties, right? Whether you have tribalism or you have the underfunded nature of Congress, the inability for members to focus because they're too busy raising money. There are all these reasons why Congress can't work. So the one time that it does, you're like, well, why can't it work that way the whole time, right? So this was an interesting and special case. So the House Antitrust Subcommittee on July 29th did this hearing with the four big tech CEOs. So you're talking Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai of Google, and Tim Cook of Apple. And, you know, going into this, these are four major CEOs that you could probably have a hearing with each one of them. There was only 5 minutes per round for speakers. It just seemed like it wasn't going to work. And right. Yet it did. And the reason it did is because these members were not just well-prepared, but really well-informed. This was the culmination of a year-long investigation into tech monopolies and how they impact their business and the industry and society. The Democrats on this panel really knew what they were talking about, and they had a mission. And they knew exactly where they wanted to go with this hearing. And even though the rounds were short, they were able to really get in their points and extract real kind of admissions of guilt from these big tech CEOs. So I was incredibly impressed by this hearing.
All right. So lay out for us, presumably, and then we'll get to the Republicans, because there was some contributions there. I think to a certain extent, some of them saw this all about shadow banning conservative material,
yes.
You know, and I, you know, why isn't Dave Rubin's tweets getting more play? But with that said, what was starting out, maybe compare and contrast your perspective of what you thought this should accomplish, what your understanding was of the Democrats on the committee's sense of what this should accomplish.
Yeah. So, Democrats on the committee had a wealth of material to draw from. So first, they, as I've said, they had done this investigation for over a year. They had compiled interviews with former employees at these companies. They had talked to a lot of suppliers and partners and individuals and businesses that had to work on these platforms. These are all platform companies, meaning that, you know, Amazon.com is an e-commerce platform, and they have these sellers come on and sell things on the platform. Facebook is a social media platform, and so
on. So, just to be clear on one thing, let me just, David, one thing. I mean, mm-hmm. what you're describing is essentially these are the people who own the pipes. And and when what goes through the pipes is sometimes their own stuff and other people's stuff, but
right.
but let me just back up just a little bit more too. The mm-hmm. idea is that the antitrust subcommittee, I know this may be a little remedial, but is looking for violations of antitrust as defined, because this is where this is a crucial. A distinction between the antitrust as practiced over the past 30 or so years and the antitrust that was practiced prior to that.
Right.
Just remind people of that distinction, that we're living in the sort of the University of Chicago Borkian version of antitrust that the Republicans in some way embrace for the most part, and a renewed sense of what antitrust really means that has in part come from just sort of a growing movement. And
so, yes,
delineate absolutely. That and tell me how the Democrats, which ones sort of accept that new old, as it were, original version of what antitrust means, so that when we talk about this investigation that they did over the past year, we know what they were looking at and what they were looking for.
Yeah. Absolutely. Democrats were really looking to the past. So the last 40 years, antitrust law has really been consumed with this thing called the consumer welfare standard. And what that means is that as long as consumer welfare is enhanced, and usually what that means is as long as prices are low, then mergers can go through and companies can get bigger. And, you know, we have a case where Facebook and Google don't in any formal way charge people to use their service. So obviously they're on a consumer welfare framework, maybe you would see Facebook and Google as absolutely fine. So what the Democrats on the committee were looking at was the imposition of market power in terms of the rivals that these companies had. So there was a lot of talk about Facebook's purchase of Instagram and how they essentially muscled that company into being purchased by them by creating a clone that was essentially Instagram software only on Facebook, and that this strategy of either copying or acquiring or killing companies is the way in which Facebook and these other big tech firms acquire power. So that was one way. The other way is abusing the entities that are on this platform that in many ways these companies compete against while also hosting the platform. So, for example, Amazon sells its own stuff and also allows third-party sellers to come on and sell stuff. And the third-party sellers are paying more and more for the privilege of being on Amazon.com. It started out at 19% of their sales, and now it's 30% of their sales. That's gone up in a few years' time. Seemingly, they need to buy more from Amazon in order to get noticed on Amazon.com. So that was another thing that came out in the hearing. Also, the use of the data of these firms that sell on Amazon.com. Amazon collects that data and uses it to inform its own purchases, its own products that it sells on Amazon.com to compete with these third-party sellers. So,
just to be clear, you know, like if they see that, people really like the blue bucket as opposed to the red bucket, they'll go out and sell blue buckets because they're watching the bucket seller. Right.
That's right. So those were the kinds of things that the Democrats focused on. And it harkens back to a time when antitrust was about power and about competition rather than just being about consumer welfare. Now, what were the Republicans doing? Well, there was a lot of talk about shadow banning, but not exclusively so. There was just as much talk about, anti-competitive practices and things like that from the Republican side. And even that talk about shadow banning, it kind of implicitly what it's saying is you, Facebook, have so much power that if you weaken the voice of a conservative on your network, then that has a dramatic real world effect. So it's an expression of the power of these companies, even though it's kind of silly because the top stories on Facebook are invariably conservative stories. And this is kind of working the refs. You can kind of see it that way. But the problem, of course, is that Facebook is a ref, that it's this essential communications infrastructure that is, one of the primary nodes by which Americans get information. That's the whole problem. And Republicans, even when they were kind of engaging in this silly shadow banning discussion, they're implicitly saying you have too much power.
Right. Right. And maybe in a bit we can touch on sort of, how you address that. I mean, I know how you address the idea that Amazon is using their power as a marketplace. And really, in many respects, they want to be the marketplace, not a marketplace, but they want to be the marketplace. Right. When they're using that to compete against these little, people who are using their platform, they're just, it is very much like what they did with, frankly, their contest to see who is going to get the headquarters, right? They're just going to extract all of the information they can from a locality. In this instance,
data so that they know where to put their locations, where to put retail locations, where to put warehouses and things, because they know the development in the future of these municipalities for many years down the road. So absolutely, yes. But, Amazon just wants to collect rent, right? They don't really care if the transaction is with Amazon's own brand or with a third-party seller or anywhere down the line. They just want a piece of it. As long as they can get a piece of all of these transactions, they're going to be fine. And so, that's, I think, a market problem. That's a problem of dominance that I think the antitrust subcommittee did a very good job of displaying.
Right. And there's, the solutions there are a little bit more obvious, right? Like, you can't collect this data, or you can't sell products that are already on your in your platform, or this is these are things
structural
that are,
separation is what it's called.
Indeed.
You can't be the creator of the platform and a seller on the platform. You can say that. That's Glass-Steagall is a structural separation between investment and commercial banks. We've had these all across history, and that's one example of what you could do. You could do that with Google and say you can't be the search engine that gets a lot of ads and also run the ad exchange. Like, we can separate that structurally so that you aren't using your leverage to create the marketplace for all these ad auctions on
just to
on
be clear,
ads.
This concept has been in practice in this country for 100 years. I mean, this is what they did with the movie business. You could not own a theater chain and also be the producer of films. And then that expanded to television.
And it translated into television with the FinCEN deals. Yes, exactly.
Indeed. And so this idea is that, and we had that with the phone company too, right? I mean, you need to open up the lines.
Well, that was slightly different. That was slightly different, and that's actually more of a model towards what do you do about Facebook, right? So what you're talking about is really common carrier allowances. So, these phone lines, they might be owned by AT&T, but if you have a Verizon customer and an AT&T customer, they have to connect the call through those lines. It's you can't discriminate between services And you have to allow that call to go through in the same way as a call that's point to point from, you know, people who from AT&T subscribers that own that pipe. So that's kind of a way you can think about Facebook, maybe, like this common carrier regulation and anti-discrimination regulation could allow a way to make, for example, the new networks interoperable with Facebook. So if I build a new social network called, I don't know, Dave Watch. So Dave Watch, then if you go on there and you want to bring over all your friends and your data and make sure that they see them, then you would be able to do so. And that's sort of a common carrier kind of style of regulation.
And is that yes. And does that address, does that common carrier regulation, does that address the problem of Facebook is so dominant that if I'm not allowed to put my videos up there, that it is hurting my business or stifling my speech? I mean, does that yeah. address that? Like, how do you deal with that problem?
Well, the whole point is Facebook has what is called a network effect. So because everyone's on Facebook, everyone has to be on Facebook, right? Like, that's the idea. So if you make Facebook interoperable with Dave Watch and you want to just put your stuff on Dave Watch, you can make it so that this interoperability means that everybody who's your friend on Facebook gets to see your stuff on Dave Watch. And at that point, Facebook and Dave Watch have to compete with one another to see what best services they can provide to people. And then, you know, you have some competition in that space. So that's kind of the idea behind interoperability. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's generally the idea.
And so, as the Democrats, like, what were they trying to do in this instance? Were they basically trying to queue up instances that could be actionable down the road? Were they trying to educate people? Were they trying to scare the CEOs? Like, what was the political agenda here?
Well, I mean, I'll talk about what the formal agenda is and then what how that can be applied. So formally, they were engaged in evidentiary hearing that's going to inform a report that will be written in the fall that describes all of the things they found in this investigation and what needs to potentially be done to these companies in order to prevent their anti-competitive practices and their market power, and what new legislation potentially may need to be added so that these harms can be addressed, and what needs to be done by the actual antitrust authorities, which is the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, to actually enforce the laws on the books that these companies seem to violate. I mean, you know, to me, the biggest loser in this entire set of hearings were those agencies, because they had all the same information that the subcommittee had, and they didn't act on any of it. I mean, they had the documents that showed Mark Zuckerberg saying very plainly, we're buying Instagram to take out a competitor, which is not legal in any way. And yet they allowed that merger to go forward. In fact, the lead Republican on the subcommittee, who was against changing any kind of antitrust laws, used that as an excuse. He said, look, the FTC passed that merger. And, you know, you have to say he's not wrong. Like, this was a failure of those agencies. So what does this then tee up politically? So we could have a new president in January, and that president is going to have the power to staff those two antitrust agencies in the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. And now we will have this roadmap in terms of a report that says, these are the things that these tech firms have done wrong. These are the things that should be investigated and enforced by these agencies. And these are the new laws that we might need to continue to address them. And so we're not going to be in the dark here. You know, the Biden administration, should it come to pass, is going to be held accountable to the outcomes of this report and up against, you know, met up against what they actually do. Are they going to hire people who are aggressive in those agencies? Are they going to agree that the laws need to be changed or modified, or just that the guidelines, the interpretation of the current laws need to be changed? All of that is going to be in this report. It's going to be a focal point for looking at how the Biden administration handles corporate power. And I think to that extent, it's going to be a very valuable document.
And presumably, the more that the public gets invested in this, the more there is a mandate that is being pushed by Congress for a Biden administration to actually take this body of law seriously.
Right. And Congress as well, right? Because to the extent that there are questions or legal statutes that this subcommittee recommends for the next Congress to do, and that Congress should be probably more Democratic at this point, given the polls, that puts pressure on the leadership in the Democratic Party to move those through. I mean, this is your blue ribbon antitrust panel that worked for a year on all facets of this industry, and saying we need to do these A, B, and C. And so we now get to see if Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team actually moves forward with that. So I totally agree with you that this is going to start from below, that this is now information that can be used by a movement at the bottom to force the political system to act. I mean, that's a big part of what I write about in the book of what's needed to create that force that can challenge corporate power. Otherwise, left to their own devices, giant corporations have a major leg up with respect to Congress. So this is important to a yardstick for the Biden campaign, and also a yardstick for Congress.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you this. How much does what we are going through now, what I think we can safely anticipate we're going to be going through in the months, if not years to come, in terms of the economic hardship that is going to be a function mm-hmm. of the pandemic we're going through. And, you know, you and I spoke about the CARES Act. The one of the biggest problems of the CARES Act, I mean, there were some things, you know, problems of omission, but the problem of inclusion was simply that it was what you would write if you wanted to continue to enhance the power imbalance between mm-hmm. big corporations and everybody else. And by everybody yeah. else, I mean small businesses and even moderate sized businesses. I mean, they basically were given a, you know, it was like they were invited to a fire sale and they were told, like, here's daddy's credit card, go to town. And you believe me, anything you buy here, you're going to be able to resell it twice the value, be able to pay me back.
I mean, we're already seeing it. We're already seeing a tremendous resurgence in mergers after a few months of kind of uncertainty. Mergers have definitely come back. There's a story just recently in the New York Times that maybe a third of New York City small businesses are gone for good mm-hmm. And will not come back. I know I'm seeing similar things here in Los Angeles. So there's just going to be a consolidation by default, just because so many businesses are going to be you know, out of town and done. And the large companies that could afford to stay in the game are going to be the only ones left. So just for that alone, and then you add on the fact that there are all these sort of distress companies that are prime targets for acquisition is going to consolidate the sphere even more. So yes, from an economic standpoint, we're going to see this trend of concentration in the economy that we've seen for the last 40 years accelerate. But it does not have, that's not preordained. It doesn't have to be that way. If you have an antitrust division that is committed to promote more competition, you could see plenty of divestitures and breakups mandated. And you know, there'd be some court fights over it, obviously,
right.
But you know, a more aggressive Justice Department kind of feeds on itself. I mean, and same with Congress. We haven't seen hearings like this in the last 50 years plus, and we haven't seen what the effect of that will be on the marketplace. Will other companies want to put themselves in the position to be under fire the way that these companies were under fire? Will that have an impact on merger decision making? And will new hires that are more aggressive, should that come to pass, also have that impact? So, I mean, sometimes, Gary Reback, who was one of the lead lawyers in the Microsoft case in the late 1990s, he has a famous quote where he says, "The trial is the remedy." And what he was talking about was in the Microsoft case, just having a trial, just putting them on trial was enough to sort of chill this very aggressive posture that they had within Microsoft to just destroy all competition in their path. So the trial was the remedy. And I think, you know, you could say in this case, the hearing is the remedy, or at least part of the remedy, to, you know, knowing that there's signs of life in the political system to crack down on monopolies. The business world that is looking to consolidate sort of has to respect that.
David Dayen, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
David Dayen is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He is the author of Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Buy this book, folks. So what do you get when you have an administration rife with incompetence and corruption? Well, you get an explosion of fraud and corporate malfeasance. Here to discuss why there's never been a better time to be a white-collar criminal, former federal prosecutor Ankush Kadari. So, Ankush, this is an area where I think intuitively people might guess at this, but it is still pretty outrageous when you lay out the data like you have in this piece. But you are making the argument that there's never been a better time to be a white collar criminal. Maybe we'll save for the end as to whether, you know, if this actually is generating more white collar crime or you know, whether having the cop essentially not on the beat increases the amount of white collar crime, or if it's simply that people are not being taken off the beat, as it were, and so there's just more crime to be committed. But lay out some of the specifics of your argument here.
So basically, I think there are two fairly stark trends that we've seen over the last few years that have become more pronounced in unprecedented ways under the Trump administration. The first is that the number of prosecutions for white collar crime have fallen to an unprecedentedly low number, dropped again and again. So there have been at least three or four times at which the numbers hit a new unprecedented low based on data that Syracuse University maintains and that they've maintained for over 30 years. So this goes back a significant amount of time, and it's a significant trend. Now, at the same time, you know, one hypothesis might be, well, we're enforcing these, you know, financial fraud laws and white collar criminal laws less because maybe there's less crime. But on the other side of the ledger, the data seems to be pretty robust in showing that, in fact, white collar crimes and financial frauds are at unprecedentedly high levels. And unlike certain other crimes like violent crime, the FBI doesn't conduct surveys to try to estimate the true prevalence of white-collar crime in the community, but there are data sources from within and outside the government. So the FBI tracks internet crime and has done so for about the last 20 years. And this year, internet crime hit an all-time high. The Federal Trade Commission tracks consumer fraud complaints. Those are at an all-time high. The University of Pennsylvania released a paper through its Institute of Law and Economics earlier this year showing that there had been unprecedented levels of reports of misconduct to financial regulators. And even in the private sector, PricewaterhouseCoopers released a report earlier this year based on a survey of 5,000 companies throughout the world who reported fraud and economic crime rates at record highs. So that is about as consistent a trend and body of evidence that I have seen. And it's sort of, you know, when I got into it, I had this intuition, like you said, that maybe, you know, things are worse than they have been in the past. But I frankly did not expect to see it this stark.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, is there any evidence that maybe there is less arrests or investigations into white collar crime because in this era, suddenly folks who used to engage in that have become just their integrity has increased and their sense of obligation to society has increased. And therefore, people are just not committing these type of crimes. Is there even like, you know, just for the sake of doing our due diligence, is there even the slightest hint that that's the case?
You know, I don't think there's anything meaningful, and it is something we have to grasp for purposes of due diligence. You're right. I think that the closest that we could come to sort of feeling our way toward that hypothesis would be, well, you know, we're in the midst of a significant economic decline, and traditionally, when that has happened over the last couple of decades, we have seen an uptick in white-collar enforcement, and we have seen sort of enforcement authorities react and sort of dig up additional prosecutions and initiate additional prosecutions. So it's sort of been tempting to see, you know, white-collar crime is following this trend in which, you know, when the economy is doing well, they're at relatively low levels. And so until earlier this year, the economy was doing pretty well. And I think probably if you ask most people, they would have suspected that that suggested that, you know, there wasn't actually widespread, you know, corporate or financial malfeasance. But as I said, the data just does not back that up. So I find it very hard to see any scenario in which there is a real meaningful explanation for this besides actual increases in the prevalence of misconduct.
So before we go into the details of this, what appears to be rollback in terms of enforcement of white collar crime, does the fact that the FBI does not keep track of these things, does that indicate that maybe there is a pre-existing disposition against pursuing white collar crimes? I mean, I've interviewed Jesse Eisenberg on this program, who wrote a book called "The Chicken Crap Club," more or less. And I mean, look, we also know, for instance, that the FBI, there is no federal record keeping of things like police misconduct and whatnot. And there is a general sense that the government keeps data on stuff it really cares about and doesn't keep data on stuff that it's really not terribly invested in. Is there a, and without, you know, I think you have established that we're looking at records, but is there was the bed made essentially? Is it, you know, would it be harder to reduce enforcement of other things that the federal government pursues than this, because there was already a significant amount of lack of will?
Well, I think it's exactly, it's very telling that the FBI does not conduct the sorts of surveys that it does for violent crime. And I do think it does reflect a lesser, I guess, political or institutional willingness to pursue this sort of misconduct. And that's a long story. I mean, I think as Jesse Eisinger's book describes, you know, in the wake of 9/11, a lot of FBI agents were reassigned from traditional white collar work to terrorism and homeland security type work. And that trend is largely held up. But you can't fix what you don't track. And as you said, I think it tells us something that this is information that the government isn't even trying to collect in a systematic way. And now that they do, the FBI data I referred to earlier, they do track sort of actual complaints, but there's a significant difference between that and what they do, for instance, in cases of sexual assault or robbery or burglary, where they actually try to pick up the phone or conduct through ordinary survey methods outreach to people throughout the country and learn whether or not they've been victimized, irrespective of whether they reported that victimization to law enforcement authorities or not. And so I do think it's quite stunning. And, you know, if I had my way and, you know, I could wave a magic wand, that would be the first and most obvious thing to fix in an apparatus that has, you know, been problematic for many years, but as I've tried to lay out, gotten precipitously worse under this administration. But that needs to change. I mean, I see no defensible explanation for that at all.
All right, so let's talk about the different things that are inhibiting the, or presumably inhibiting, the pursuit of these white-collar crimes. I mean, one of the things you lay out is just simply other priorities. Certainly in the wake of 9/11, a lot of investigatory apparatus was focused on tracking financial, terrorism's financial ties and whatnot. Is there a similar analog here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been concerted efforts during this administration to focus first on immigration and, you know, under the Sessions regime, that was his sort of singular focus. And that attracted a lot of resources within the department and attention publicly. It's a truly shameful, I think, period of the history of the Justice Department that particular crackdown in the family separation policy, and one that I think needs to be excavated in the next administration. But nevertheless, for our current purposes, that was a serious diversion of attention and resources to a problem of debatable significance. But factually, that was a significant diversion of attention and resources. And, you know, since then, his permanent successor, at least Bill Barr, has focused seemingly on, you know, political retribution through Justice Department mechanisms for the Russiagate investigation, the Mueller investigation. And, you know, this is a whole separate discussion that, you know, you've had in separate pieces many times before, but you know, he's been very willing to use the Justice Department as an arm of the president's sort of personal and political agenda and grievances. So it's not the only reason by any means, but, you know, the attorney generals have a lot of influence, obviously, in how they set the agenda for the agency and the sorts of things that prosecutors go after. And this has not been their priority by any means.
So there's a bunch of other priorities. And there's been also, you write about policy changes that have impacted these type of investigations. Outline those for us.
Yeah, you know, there have been a few notable policy changes. One is a policy expansion, really. Under the tail end of the Obama administration, there was an effort to introduce a pilot program for foreign bribery investigations, in which there was sort of an explicit policy that if you self-reported your company's misconduct, that the government might sort of give you a pass. Self-reported and sort of fully cooperated and disclosed all the underlying misconduct. There is some merit, arguable merit to that in the context of corporate foreign bribery, because there are already significant difficulties that the government has detecting and pursuing that sort of conduct. But that policy got expanded basically more globally under this administration, and it allows prosecutors to decline pursuing corporate criminal cases if they self-report and cooperate with investigators. And a separate policy, which has been referred to as sort of the anti-piling on policy, is a policy in which the Justice Department has said, well, you know, if there are parallel criminal and civil investigations and civil regulators are entering into a resolution and imposing a fine, well, it just doesn't make sense for the Justice Department to quote unquote pile on and impose even further fines. Now, there was already a mechanism for the Justice Department to account for the existence and resolution of parallel proceedings, but this made explicit and more prominent the notion that, well, if you have sort of paid civil regulators for some potential misconduct, then you know, the Justice Department may not need to get involved, or may need to do so in a more lenient capacity. And third, you know, the end of the Obama administration, there was a policy put in place that encouraged prosecutors to focus more intently on prosecuting individuals in the context of these sort of widespread corporate criminal cases. And that policy had been enacted in response to the anger, justifiable anger, really, that people throughout the country had about there being very few, pretty much no real meaningful prosecutions at a high level in the wake of the financial crisis. There were lots and lots of settlements and lots of fines paid to the Justice Department and civil regulators, but very few actual criminal prosecutions. And so the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, wrote a memo saying, look, you can't just, you know, settle these cases and move on. If you're prosecuting these cases, you need to pursue individuals in a very serious, robust way. And it laid out a series of steps for prosecutors to do that. And that policy has been rolled back under this administration, which basically makes it acceptable to sort of enter into a multi-million-dollar settlement with a company and move along without prosecuting anyone necessarily, but without really forcing prosecutors to pursue all of the relevant individual wrongdoers. So those sorts of programmatic policy changes have been relatively few, but they are significant, particularly in the white collar context.
So, I mean, the last two at the very least were one, if you commit a bunch of crimes, you get a couple of freebies, essentially. And the other is that you really can hide behind this corporate shield and don't have to take any personal accountability.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the freebie policy, as you put it, it's well put, because basically, like, if you you get a pass on your first one, really, if you just admit it, would be the most simple way of putting it. That's a simplistic account of it, but you know, the policy is not a good policy, and problematic for that reason.
All right. So with all this said, and there's one other element that's going on here, right? I mean, they have other priorities which provide them, you know, where they divert resources. They have policy changes that sort of, I guess, you know, once you have diverted those resources, you make some policy changes that make it very easy for you to rubber stamp and essentially slap people on the wrist, you know, or at the very least, you know, pat them on the back, it almost sounds like, in some instances. They also, the Justice Department, has a And you know, I've spoken to people who were in the Justice Department during the Clinton administration and then came back during the Obama administration to talk about the degradation, frankly, of different divisions of the Justice Department as a function of the administration not being interested in the missions of specific departments in DOJ. And so what happens is people get discouraged. They leave. You lose some institutional memory. People who are contemplating moving into the government, they see that there's no place for them to go and they don't want to get anywhere near it because of the administration. And so there is no sort of like bench or folks coming up. And you write about in the piece about political appointees who are seem completely inept and unqualified to be doing the things that they're doing. And A, tell us about those. But B, how much of that is a part of what Steve Bannon announced within the first 6 months of this administration? Was their agenda is to deconstruct the administrative state. And it's a very easy thing to do, right? I mean, you don't have to be a genius to tear these things down. In fact, it helps if you're not a genius and you'll be appointed in an important position and you'll just let it basically die on the vine.
Yeah. Yes. So to take the first piece, there have been some really stunning, I think, appointments and promotions even at the career level. But to take some prominent, you know, political appointments, I mentioned a guy in the piece named Bill Hughes, who is an associate deputy attorney general and who is leading the administration's criminal enforcement effort regarding coronavirus-related misconduct. I happened to be at home just watching a hearing that he was testifying at before the Senate Judiciary Committee with several other people. I had never heard of or seen the guy before. And I was just watching it and I was just sort of slack-jawed because he just seemed like in way over his head. And so I just kind of went and looked up his bio on LinkedIn, and it turns out he's has no experience in the Justice Department. He was in private practice and then at the White House. And his only real contact with the internal workings of the Justice Department was working as a law student intern 15 years ago at a U.S. attorney's office. And this man is supposed to be coordinating our response to potential criminal misconduct throughout the country arising from coronavirus. And he's in over his head. And you know, that bio, once I saw it, really, I was still stunned, but it made more sense of the fact that he just seemed completely uninformed and ignorant of a lot of basic features of sort of the criminal process. He couldn't answer very basic questions that Senator Dianne Feinstein was putting to him about, like, well, what are you going to do to arrest and actually convict people? Which is a question that is simple on its face, but to answer in any meaningful way, you do have to actually understand a little thing or two about how criminal prosecutions and investigations work. And he appears not to do so. Another guy who was until recently the head of the criminal division, who I don't talk about in the piece, but it is this guy named Brian Benczkowski, who I had met on a couple occasions, perfectly nice guy interpersonally, but he had never actually been a prosecutor before he became the head of the criminal division. And so as a result, you know, he had very little understanding coming into the job of how like actual criminal prosecutions work. And, you know, if you don't understand how these things work, you're not going to be able to really ask the right questions, the right and set interesting or creative priorities. And I do think that there is a sense in which at best there's indifference that allows people like that to be put into positions of importance like that. But there is kind of, I do have the similar sort of feeling that there is a sort of a sense in which it's sort of a deliberate policy of sort of putting in place people who will sort of let these, let the sort of the apparatus kind of wither a little bit, because I think in the long term, it does take a toll to have inexperienced and sort of unknowledgeable people at the helm. You know, good career people leave. They don't really put up with it. They don't like it. They don't enjoy their jobs. and that institutional knowledge is not really replaceable. And at the same time, you know, one of the things, dynamics, I think, that has been not fully explored, I think, publicly, but one of the things I wanted to get into in my piece was that there's been this sort of vacuum at the senior career levels that has allowed really unqualified career people to migrate to very senior positions. And I mentioned a couple people who worked in the office I worked in who, you know, they were perfectly fine, you know, interpersonally by and large. But on paper, they had no business holding the positions that they hold. And, you know, again, by itself, maybe, you know, this isn't so bad, or you can't draw a one-to-one comparison between that and the real pervasive problem we have. But it is one more piece of this really, you know, holistic problem we have. It's like you don't care about it. You don't have the right people in place. It's a significant problem in and of itself.
So it seems like we have two significant problems. One is that it is basically open season on citizens and consumers and presumably, I guess, other businesses, because there is a significant absence of investigation and essentially policing of these white collar crimes. And then the other is that it's not just like it's been, you know, the apparatus has been dipped in amber and somebody's just waiting for it to thaw out in some fashion. The apparatus is being deconstructed. So here's my question is, and we obviously, we can't really know, we have some figures in terms of like cost, but we can't really know the price that is being paid by people who are subjected to more crime because of the lack of enforcement. Do you have a sense of what's happening with the infrastructure? Like, when Joe Biden comes, if Joe Biden's president, and presumably different people are put at the DOJ, can they come in and fix this initially? I mean, and let's be clear. I mean, we had an attorney general under Obama who had a, you know, very closely hewed to a notion of, you know, too big to jail. And so, you know, we didn't start off from a decent place. It just seems like we've been able to sort of deconstruct an apparatus that was insufficient in many respects to begin with.
Yeah, you know, this is, that is correct. I mean, the piece that I wrote focuses on kind of the sort of the bottom falling out under the Trump administration, but this was already a problem even under the Obama administration. And I think it got more attention, fortunately, and at least some attention from Congress and the media. But because of sort of the swarm of incessant scandals in this administration, it's sort of fallen by the wayside. But I'm deeply concerned, actually, about what might happen in a Biden administration, not because I think he or his people would be have bad intentions, but just because I've frankly seen no indication that the campaign is interested in this particular issue, at least publicly. And, you know, Biden was the vice president under Obama. And if we have a return of some of the same people who held senior positions under the Obama DOJ, some of them were quite good. But we can't really expect things to change with the same sorts of people in place. And I think the challenge is harder now because, as you say, you know, you have sort of the an institutional apparatus that has not been held in amber. And it's not something that you can just flip a switch on. A lot of serious thought needs to be given to not just programmatic and policy issues, but staffing issues, resource issues, prioritization of certain areas of enforcement over others. And I don't think it's a problem that can be fixed just with a new group of people. I think it will take not just a new group of people, although I think that's a necessary but not sufficient condition, but a very concerted effort to look at all levels of the problem and to think, you know, creatively about, well, what can we be doing differently, you know, even irrespective of Trump. I mean, one thing that I think has come into stark relief under the Trump administration, but again, it's sort of a years-long trend, is like the financial, international financial system has just become so opaque and so prone to abuse and misuse by financial criminals that I don't really think the domestic law enforcement apparatus has kept up with it. And I think we need not just a new group of people, but people who are going to come in and think hard, long and hard about this and expansively about how to kind of change directions.
I'm not going to hold my breath, but hope springs eternal. Ankush Kadari, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Ankush Kadari is a former federal prosecutor who specialized in financial fraud. His work has been published by The Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Slate, and The American Prospect. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Special thank you to all our free podcast subscribers who converted into members this week to support the show. Can't thank you enough. As you know, we're keeping it all open during this era of COVID. But if you're listening to the free podcast, consider becoming a member for the full show over at rofpodcast.com. It is our members who make the show possible. We have no other sources of revenue. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. You head over to majority.fm. Check out my daily live stream at noon or later as a podcast. Also, don't forget AM Quickie. 7 minutes of progressive headlines first thing in the morning. AM Quickie, totally free. You can get it at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are served. I am Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.